In his famous Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets." That's a very familiar scripture to all of us here. It's been very important to us over the years. We've seen it in publication in our literature, heard it in sermons and Bible studies time and time again. But the question I have is, what was it that prompted Jesus to make this statement? Why did he say such a thing? After all, it certainly no Jewish rabbi of that period would think that the Messiah had come to abolish the law. There may have been some on the fringe elements who had some weird ideas about what the Messiah might do and how that he might somehow rearrange or abolish the law or whatever, but that's in the mainstream among the rabbinic sages of that period of time. Among the Pharisees, certainly no one believed that the Messiah would come and abolish the law, because they knew what the prophets said. They understood all the prophecies about the coming Davidic king and during his reign, how that Jerusalem would be restored to its greatness, how that Israel and Judah would be gathered together as one nation again, and how that the law would go forth from Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, how that the Feast of Tabernacles would be observed, the temple would be in place, the sacrifices would be ongoing. So they understood these things and certainly didn't conceive of a Messiah, a Davidic king, who would come and abolish the law. So again, the question is, why did Jesus make this statement? Well, it seems to me that the most plausible explanation is that he was about to teach something. He was about to say something that might lead some, or give some, the impression that he was, in fact, abolishing the law. Well, if that's the case, just what was it? The question before us is this: what did Jesus do to the law? If he didn't abolish it, if he didn't abolish it or do away with it, what did he do to the law? And I think this is an important question, because it's one that's greatly misunderstood with all the concepts and ideas about the law and what Jesus did to it, and how it relates to the Christian today, how it relates to us in our modern 20th century. It's a very important question. Did he do away with some of the laws and replace them with spiritual principles? That's one of the most prominent ideas out there in the evangelical world, and sometimes I find it even within the Church of God. Did he abolish some of the laws and allow other laws to remain in place, but with new interpretations? Did he radically revise the law and give it a brand new spiritual dimension that nobody prior to his time could have possibly understood? Is that what he did? Did he make it more spiritual? In other words, in the Old Covenant, did we have physical circumcision, but in the New Covenant, it's now been transformed into spiritual circumcision, or circumcision of the heart, as it is called. And what about the physical sacrifices under the Old Covenant? Are they now transformed into spiritual sacrifices? As we read in the New Testament, we offer spiritual sacrifices. Or the idea goes that in the Old Covenant, they had a physical temple and a physical priesthood offering these physical sacrifices. But now in the New Covenant, it's a spiritual temple. We are the temple of God, and we're offering spiritual sacrifices. The problem is, when you follow that line of reasoning, is somewhere along the way in the spiritualizing of things, the excessive spiritualizing of things, somebody comes up with a brilliant new idea that, well, everything is spiritual now. You can go to 1 Corinthians 5, and you'll find that, sure enough, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is now spiritual. Paul says, and if you interpret it from the Greek, one rendition could be, "Let us be keeping festival." It's an ongoing festival. And so our unleavened bread is the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Same with the Sabbath, and of course, most of us here are aware of another organization that's using just that line of reasoning in spiritualizing things away. But what are the differences? Are those really the differences between the Old Covenant law, as it is called, and the law as it is understood and to be applied in the New Covenant? Did Jesus really internalize and spiritualize and therefore revive and add a revise a brand new spiritual dimension to the law, one that could not have been comprehended before? For example, in Matthew chapter 5, in verse 21, he says, "You have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder, and whosoever commits murder shall be liable to the court.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court." And goes on to say in the latter part of verse 22, that whoever says, "You fool," meaning simply just talking about exhibiting a spirit of hatred, shall be guilty enough to go into Gehenna fire. So the idea is that Jesus, in adding this brand new spiritual dimension to the law, actually transformed the law. He made it new. In the old covenant, it was just to do with, had to do with physical and outward and material things, but in the new covenant, it's a matter of the heart. My question, is that true? Is that what he did to the law? Let's look at some other examples, and these are commonly used in expressing this particular view of the law. In verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you," you know, people say the very fact that he says, "But I say to you," shows that he's either revising or somehow overturning some aspect of the law that he has in mind. And sure enough, the Ten Commandments do say, "Do not commit adultery." And then he says, "I say to you, but everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart." Now, does this mean that under the Old Covenant that adultery was merely a matter of the actual act, but in the New Covenant it's now a matter of the heart, first and foremost? Well, we'll come to some of these questions later and deal with them. But in verse 31 he says, "And it was said, whosoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity makes her commit adultery, and whosoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Now, in this new spiritual dimension that Jesus supposedly is adding to the law, does this mean now that certain of the Mosaic commandments are being overthrown because they have no place? The new spiritual dimension will not allow them to remain in force. And hence, some laws are overthrown, some are renewed. Is that what is going on here? In verse 38, he says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil." Is he overthrowing the eye for eye, tooth for tooth law and replacing it with something that is more spiritual in content? Is he adding some new spiritual dimension that could not have possibly been understood by Moses or anyone who preceded the time of Christ? These are important questions because they tell us how we are to approach the law once we understand what Jesus is talking about. So let's look at the teachings of Jesus in this chapter, Matthew 5, several of the things that he said about specific points in the law, and let's see what he really said. But before we do that, I'd like to go back to several Old Testament passages and see some principles that perhaps even some of us in this room have not understood before. I know that I find commonly that people have some of these ideas. Perhaps they bring them into the church with them from the churches they were in before. But they have a lot of ideas, and then when you bring out certain scriptures to them right out of the law of Moses, they're oftentimes astounded to find that those things were taught by Moses himself. So let's see some things that Moses taught before we look at the teachings of Jesus. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, if you would turn there with me, Deuteronomy, the 10th chapter, and beginning in verse 14, "Behold, to the Lord your God," I'm reading from the New American Standard Bible, if you notice that it differs from your King James, if that's what you're reading. Verse 14, he says, "Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it. Yet on your fathers did the Lord set his affection to love them, and he chose their descendants after him, even you above all the peoples as it is this day. Circumcise then your heart and stiffen your neck no more." The circumcision of the heart, this is in the law of Moses, an Old Testament principle. That's what God sought for the people of Israel. Now, for anyone who thought that that was a brand new idea introduced in the New Testament, you see, it's wrong. And you will find, if you'll just look up the word, you'll find that this is repeated over and over several times in the law and in the prophets, this concept of the circumcision of the heart. So where did the New Testament writers get this idea? Well, from the law, from the Old Testament, from the existing scriptures, and they understood it just as it's being presented here. In Leviticus 26, you find the same principle essentially. Leviticus 26, and beginning in verse 40, "If they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers, in their unfaithfulness which they committed against me, and also in their acting with hostility against me, I also was acting with hostility against them to bring them into the land of their enemies, or if their uncircumcised heart becomes humbled so that they can then make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob. So here again you find the same principle, and I'll refer you without turning there to Jeremiah 4:4 and Jeremiah 9:25, where we find the same thing reiterated again. So throughout the law and the prophets, this concept of the circumcision of the heart, which really speaks of a contrite and broken heart, a heart of a repentance, a heart of obedience, is found. So don't think it's a New Testament idea. It's something that the New Testament writers knew because they had it in Scripture, in existing Scripture. And come, as you think about it, you know, the idea that somehow the rite of circumcision was transformed from the old covenant to the new, it became spiritual in the new, is really not a correct idea, because as you see, spiritual circumcision or circumcision of the heart was commanded by God through Moses. That's what God sought in the people of Israel. When Paul, the Apostle Paul, deals with that subject, the subject of whether circumcision is necessary in the New Testament, do you know what authority he goes to? The authority he goes to, in what authority he cites when he says that circumcision, physical circumcision, is unrelated to justification? None other than the Scriptures themselves, the authority of the Torah. It's taught not in explicit language, but implicitly through the narrative of Abraham, that circumcision has nothing to do with justification, because he was declared righteous on the basis of faith before the rite of circumcision was instituted. So even there, the Apostle Paul himself is not so much overthrowing. He's not doesn't recognize an overthrowing of an older rite in order to be replaced with a new spiritual dimension or new spiritual principle. He recognized what the Torah had taught all along. So what do we find new here? Let's go to Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19. And see something else that's found right here in the Law of Moses, that is, as it is called. Leviticus 19, and in verse 18, God says, "You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Eternal." Love your neighbor as yourself. Do you realize that Old Testament law is a way of love? So why is it that so many people think that the New Testament is the source of love, that that was first introduced in the New Testament, when in fact the Old Testament itself, the Law of Moses, says love your neighbor as yourself? So that's not something that is unique to the New Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 5, beginning in verse 4, the famous Shema: "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might." Now, how physical is that? How external and outward is that when you love the Lord your God with all your soul, your heart, your might? Is that not talking about the inner being, the innermost being, the inner person? Doesn't the New Testament deal with that? Is this something outward and physical about your heart, soul, and might? No, no. This is talking about you love God. This is saying you love God from your innermost being. So this, the Law of Moses does, in fact, deal with the inner man, doesn't it? Of course it does. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, Deuteronomy chapter 30, for anyone who thinks that the Old Testament law deals only with, or primarily even, with outward and physical and material things, look at Deuteronomy 30 and beginning in verse 10. "If you obey the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes which are written in this book of the law, if you will turn to the Lord your God with all your heart and soul," what is that, something outward about that, something physical? Or does it come from within? Obviously, it's something that comes from within. He's talking about the inner man, the inner person. "For this commandment which I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. It is not in heaven that you should say, 'Who will go up to heaven for us to get it, for us to make us hear it, that we may observe it?' nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross the sea, or for us to get it for us and make us hear it, that we may observe it. But the word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may observe it. So I ask you, is the law of Moses, is that some law that deals only with the outward, physical, and external matters? Or can it be described as a way of the heart? Indeed, it is a way of the heart. This is what God sought all along. When he gave the law through Moses, he had in mind the inner person, the inner being. This is where the transformation is to take place. This is what is to be affected by hearing the law. Of course, they had an opposite response because they didn't have that heart of obedience that God so desired to see within them. So with that in mind, this basic background, an understanding that the way of life that God set before Israel was a way of the heart, and in fact was intended to deal with the inner person, let's now go to the teachings of Jesus. In Matthew, the 5th chapter, and beginning again with the verse we started with, he says in verse 17, Matthew 5, verse 17, and again I'm reading from the New American Standard, he says, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments," and he's not talking about any other commandments other than those found in the law, "whoever annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever shall teach them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you," now here's the key right here. If you want to understand the text that follows, if you want to understand what Jesus has in mind as he comments on various points of the law throughout Matthew, the 5th chapter, here is a key, a very important key right here in this verse. "For I say unto you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." The scribes and the Pharisees. You see, Jesus is not taking issue with Moses in any way throughout this chapter. He's not taking issue with Moses. He is taking issue with Moses' interpreters. And as you're going to see, he's not adding some brand new spiritual dimension that could not have been comprehended at any time in the past. No, what he's doing, he's stripping away those false interpretations, those misrepresentations of the law, the fences that the Pharisees had built around the law and created all the misunderstanding. So he's not revising the law. He's taking issue with Moses' interpreters. Continuing on in verse 21, he says, to read this passage again, "You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whosoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whosoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell or Gehenna fire." And of course, this is just another way of saying that anyone who harbors the spirit of hatred has within himself a spirit of murder. Is this something new? Is this something that Moses could not have understood or comprehended? Let's go back to Leviticus 19. Hold your place here. We'll come back to Matthew 5. Leviticus 19, and read verse 17. We read verse 18 a few moments ago, but look at verse 17. God says, "You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of him." Did you realize the law of Moses forbids hatred? You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. Is this some outward or external law, something that pertains only to the material, the outward, the external, the physical? No, it's a matter of the heart. And what you find here in the law of Moses is the same thing that Jesus teaches in Matthew, the 5th chapter. The same thing he says about committing murder. Hatred against your brother is the spirit of murder. Back in Matthew 5 and verse 23, "If therefore you're presenting your offering at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering. Is this something new? Turn with me to Jeremiah, the 7th chapter, and let's take a look at a familiar scripture, one that I misunderstood in the past, but have a much clearer understanding now, where this same subject is being dealt with. In Jeremiah chapter 7, beginning in verse 21, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat flesh. What does he mean by that? Add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices. Well, you know, these are two different types of sacrifices, burnt offerings and sacrifices, and they're to be treated very differently. He's saying just put them together and treat them the same and then eat them. Eat the flesh. Why? Because he's going to tell you, it's not worth a flip to me. It's not worth a dime, these sacrifices you're offering. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, okay, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you will be my people, and you will walk and you will walk in all of my way that I command you, that it may be well with you. There was a time when I thought that what this meant was that God first gave the commandments at Mount Sinai. He gave his law, and he didn't give the sacrifices. Only later, after Israel sinned, then he added the sacrificial law. And then I would compare that with Galatians 3, where it spoke of a law that was added because of transgressions. And I thought that's what this was talking about. But that's not what it means. Actually, the truth is, the sacrificial law was built into the Mosaic law, if you want to call it that, the law of Moses, the law that God gave to Moses. It was built into it from the beginning. And the Passover sacrifice was indeed a part of this sacrificial system. And there are references, even while the Israelites were still in Egypt, there are references to the sacrificial system. The law of the firstborn, for example, and the redemption of the firstborn. So my former understanding is incorrect. This does not mean that the sacrificial law was added later. Rather, this is what it means. God is saying simply that I didn't command burnt offerings and sacrifices without moral obligation. That's what he means. He's saying, you can't treat me like a pagan god. You can't come before me with sacrifices and think that I can be appeased with so much blood being poured out on the ground. You can't bring your sacrifices before me and burn the flesh on the altar and think that somehow as it wafts up to me in heaven that I'm going to be pleased with that and that's going to get my attention. No, what I want is that heart of obedience. What I want is the broken and contrite heart. And then your sacrificial offerings are acceptable before me. That's what this means. It means he didn't command sacrifices without that moral and ethical obligation, without the heart of obedience. It's very similar to what is, you know, really that's the problem that you find in back in Isaiah, the first chapter. Isaiah chapter 1, if you turn back there, we'll take a brief look at that. In Isaiah 1, and beginning in verse 10, hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom, give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. Actually, he's talking to the people of Judah here, but he's reminding them of the fact that they're very likely to have a very temporal existence because of their sins. What are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Why were these offerings worthless? We're going to see in a few moments. He continues, incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies. I cannot endure iniquity and the solemn assembly. I hate your new moon. Festivals and your appointed feasts, they have become a burden to me. And I don't think it's correct really to say, to conclude dogmatically, that this is talking about some feasts other than the feasts he ordained. That's not the problem here, and I think we're missing the point when we assume that they had replaced those feasts with pagan feasts. He says, they have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. So when you spread out your hands, meaning in prayer, you hold up your hands, and you're praying and you're coming with your sacrifices on the holy days, he says, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Why? Well, the answer is right here. Your hands are covered with blood. He goes on. He says, wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your deeds from my sight. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, reprove the ruthless, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. You know, these people were neglecting their own flesh, their own flesh and blood, neglecting their widows, their orphans. They were driving hard their laborers. Oh yeah, they'd let them off on the Sabbath day, all right. But they'd more than make up for it when the sun went down. You know, make up double time now, and they'd drive them so hard that their servants couldn't possibly meet the demands of their masters. And yet, here they were, going before God on the festivals, the annual festivals, and every one of them, in one way or the other, picture deliverance from bondage, if you think about it. Here they were, going before God on days that picture deliverance from bondage, while actually they were placing other people under bondage. Do you see the hypocrisy there? And here they were, coming before God and raising their hands and saying, how long, O Lord, will it be before you hear us? When will you bless us? And God is saying, in effect, he's saying, look, you're missing the point of the sacrifices. A sacrifice represents the heart of obedience. It represents obedience to my commandments, which say, love your neighbor as yourself, as we have seen. Which say, be kind, even to your enemy, as we'll see later. So God is pointing out to them the hypocrisy of bringing sacrifices that represent the heart of obedience and saying, the heart of obedience is not there. You're just walking right over your own flesh and blood in pursuit of your own goals. You're just walking right by them. You're neglecting the widow and the orphan. You're not loving your neighbor as yourself. So don't bring your stinking sacrifices and place them on my altar. I won't receive them. You remember what David said in the 51st Psalm, Psalm 51, how that he said, you don't want sacrifices. If that's what you wanted, I would offer them. In other words, if that was the way I could gain your attention, I would offer sacrifices, and I'd take care of the job, just like the pagans take care of, you know, that's the way they approach their gods. They think that the gods will be moved by so much blood on the ground or so much burning flesh wafting up into the air in the smoke. But David says, you don't want sacrifices. What you want is a broken and a contrite heart. He says, and then, once a person comes to that place, he has that heart of obedience, then God will receive the sacrifices. And that's all that Jesus is saying back in Matthew 5 when he says, when you come to present your gift on the altar, and there you remember that you have something against your brother, you and your brother have some kind of problem, then leave your gift. Don't stick your gift on God's altar while you're not cleaned up on the inside, in other words. He said, you go be reconciled with your brother. You'd go and clean yourself up. You get rid of this hatred and this resentment and this lack of forgiveness. And if you don't do that, then forget about placing your gift on the altar, because it is pointless. It's worthless. It's no good. So Jesus is simply reiterating a very basic principle that is found, that is expressed very clearly in the law and in the prophets. Back to Matthew 5 once again. Matthew 5, and look at verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now here again, a lot of people think that in the Old Covenant that only the actual act of adultery was a sin. But in the New Covenant, it's now a sin even to look at a woman, to lust after her. But let's go back to Exodus 20. It's surprising to me that so many people hold that view when the Bible itself is so clear. Even the commandments themselves, the Ten Commandments, are so clear on this subject. In Exodus 20, sure enough, we find the commandment in verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. But notice what it says down in verse 17. Verse 17 says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Isn't that what Jesus said? Covet means lust. It means something you desire that is not rightfully yours. That's exactly what Jesus said. You know, if you look at the Ten Commandments, you see that there is a lawful order. In dealing with man's human relationships, the first commandment is honor your father and mother. That's where human relationships begin. The second commandment, you shall not murder. Generally speaking, that's the worst thing you can do to someone. I know there are things that people say are worse than death, but generally speaking, we're just speaking in general categories here. Murder is the worst thing you can do to somebody. The second worst thing is to commit adultery. The third, stealing. The fourth, bearing false witness. So you have those things in that order. That's a summation of the things you do to damage your neighbor. Where do all these things begin? In the heart, between the ears, as it were, in the mind. And that's why the 10th commandment is a summation commandment. It tells you where all the above, the violation of all the above, begins, in the mind. And as you think about it, you know, you realize that you don't break any of these commandments unless there is some form of covetousness there first. And that's all Jesus is saying. He's not introducing some brand new spiritual dimension that could not have been comprehended by the ancients had they had the heart of obedience, something Moses didn't know or David didn't know. He was simply taking issue with the concepts that were circulating during his own day, because the law of God had been so badly misrepresented by the Pharisees, by the scribes, by the Essenes, the Sadducees, and others. And so it was necessary to do this. Back in Matthew 5, once again, Matthew chapter 5, and in verse 31, Jesus says, "And it was said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity," or porneia is the Greek word, which takes in all kinds of unchastity, "makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Now, I was reading one commentator recently, and he said, now this definitely is a direct overthrowing of a Mosaic law. He is here definitely contravening Moses. But in actual fact, he's not. If you think about it carefully, and let me say this as an aside, because it is a touchy subject for so many people, that Jesus, when he makes this statement, he is expressing the ideal, first of all, and secondly, he does not have every situation in view when he says this thing. For example, he's not thinking in terms of spousal abuse. He does not have in his mind abandonment. And he's not thinking of those situations that the Apostle Paul deals with in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. So he is expressing the ideal as far as marriage is concerned, but he does not have every situation in view. It's a general statement. So a lot of people have a problem with the fact that we have people in the church who have divorces in their past and are now remarried. But understand, Jesus is not dealing with every situation, and there are, in fact, many situations where a second marriage can be lawfully had, lawfully obtained. But that is an aside. Jesus is really referring to the law in Deuteronomy 24, and I'd like to go back there and see what it really says and see if Jesus is, in fact, contradicting the law that Moses wrote concerning adultery, or concerning remarriage, I should say. Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, he says, "When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her," and you remember Jesus said, uses the term porneia, obviously it's referring to the same thing here, so we don't find any disagreement between Moses and Jesus on this point so far, "and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife because she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance." Now, it does appear at first glance that Jesus is saying something that is contrary to what Moses said. You know, Moses said, the way the Pharisees understood it, Moses said, yes, divorce is permissible. Jesus is saying, no, divorce is not permissible except for the cause of porneia. But in reality, that's not really what Moses is driving at here. And Jesus is pointing to the underlying principle. Why did Moses find it necessary to write this law? Of course, God inspired him to write it, but why did he write this law? What situation existed? Well, the fact is, divorce was taking place, and of course, as we know, the Israelites had a tendency to adopt the customs of the surrounding nations. And do you know how divorce occurred in the surrounding nations? Well, the people would simply have a verbal agreement. Actually, less than that, the husband would say, you're out. And it was legal. And then later on, when somebody else put the same woman out verbally and made it legal, it was legally binding, then she could come back to the original husband, or she could just go on wherever. The one woman might be the wife of several husbands over the course of a lifetime. And what does that amount to? This putting away of a woman and this taking her again and all that. Nothing more than a legalized form of wife swapping. And Moses knew that the Israelites would adopt this custom, so he had to introduce some kind of legislation to prevent that. So what is the underlying principle that Moses recognizes when he writes this law? The sanctity of marriage. Otherwise, he wouldn't have written it. Now, what is Jesus driving at in Matthew, the 5th chapter? The same principle, the sanctity of marriage. So Jesus is not contravening Moses. He's not taking issue with what Moses wrote. He's pointing to the underlying principle. You see, the Pharisees, or at least some of them, you can't paint them all with the same brush, some of them were saying that the important thing is to present her with a certificate of divorce. And Jesus says, you're missing the point. The point is that marriage is ordained of God and is sanctified. That's the point. And Moses recognized that point. You see, Moses knew that to make a divorce a little more difficult and to add the added judgment that a woman, once she's been, goes out and remarries, and that's what she's going to do more than likely because she has to have a means of support, then the idea that he can never have her back again, that would kind of put the brakes on a lot of divorces. So the purpose of this law was to preserve the sanctity of marriage. And that's what Jesus is speaking of in Matthew, the 5th chapter. So there is no contradiction between Jesus and Moses. Back in Matthew 5 again, Matthew 5 and verse 33. Jesus says, again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. And indeed, this is in all caps in my Bible, indicating it is a quote from the Old Testament. That is found in the Law of Moses. The Law of Moses did have laws concerning vows, and people made vows. But Jesus says, verse 34, but I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is evil. Jesus does not have in mind here a court of law where you're required to raise your hand and say, I do, when you're asked, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? That's not what he has in mind. He's not dealing with that. In fact, he's not saying that oaths per se are necessarily wrong. He's not saying that at all. You have to understand, you have to have you have to have the historical context in mind to really understand what he's saying here. And again, you have to realize what the religious leaders were teaching. You see, in that period of time, an oath was binding, or there were variations of how much an oath was binding. It was binding on the basis of what name the oath was made in. You know, that's how you determine how binding an oath was. For example, to swear in the name of, or by the name of Jerusalem, was not as binding as swearing by heaven. Swearing by the temple was not as binding as swearing by heaven. Now, swearing by the gold in the temple, now that was a binding vow, of course. But swearing, there was a gradation of binding, of how binding a vow was, depending on what name you used when the vow was made. To swear by my beard is not as binding as swearing by heaven. In other words, some of the Pharisees were actually using the Mosaic oath laws to get out of telling the truth. They were so interpreting them and attaching their own tradition to them that they used them to get out of telling the truth. So just the opposite occurred. Well, the oath laws were designed to encourage truth, but the Pharisees, by their tradition, made the oath laws of none effect, completely ineffectual. In fact, for one in that period of time to say, well, I swear by my beard, in effect, you know what he was saying? Well, I'm a liar. You know I'm not going to keep my word if I'm making an oath. That's why Jesus says, don't take any oath at all, because you're just telling people you're a liar. And so if you're following the Pharisaic tradition concerning oaths, then you are a liar. He says, let your yes be a real yes, an honest yes, a truthful yes, and let your no not be another way of saying yes, but a genuine no, a real no. In other words, Jesus is saying, you be what the oath law encourages. So once again, he's not contravening Moses. He is confirming Moses. He's pointing out what Moses had meant all along, not adding some brand new spiritual dimension to the law that could not have possibly been comprehended by Moses. Not at all. Continuing on, he says in verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And you find this several places in the Old Testament, in the law of Moses. He goes on to say in verse 39, but I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away him from him who wants to borrow from you. Now this is one that a lot of people have difficulty with, because it does say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So let's see that back in Exodus 21. Exodus 21, beginning in verse 23. Actually, beginning in verse 22. It says, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. And if a man strikes through the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye, and so forth. But here we have this principle of eye for eye and tooth for tooth. And a lot of people say, well, Jesus overturns that. He teaches something different. This is one of those Mosaic commandments that cannot stand due to the fact that this new spiritual element has been added, this new spiritual dimension. Actually, that's not the truth at all. Really, Jesus is telling us what this law really means. He's pointing to the underlying principle. You see, you notice in verse 22, we read right over it, it says, and he shall pay as the judges decide. This is what was up to the judges. You see, it was not a matter of personal vengeance, and that is what Jesus is taking issue with. Some were saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. In other words, because you have hurt me, Moses gives me the right to go after you and seek personal vengeance. And Jesus is saying, no, he doesn't. That's not what this law means. It does not permit personal vengeance. This was for the judges to decide, and all that law means is the compensation was to match the damages. That's what it means. It does not permit personal vengeance. And yet, that's what some of the religious leaders and some others, the way they were reading it, and Jesus, in showing how far you should put personal vengeance away from yourself, uses this illustration of how you ought to give to the one who asks of you and how you ought to go the extra mile and so forth, which is probably somewhat hyperbolic, just as when he said you ought to cut your right hand off if it causes you to sin. But nevertheless, the point is made. Put personal vengeance away from you. This law doesn't give you that right. That's not what Moses was talking about. Back in Matthew 5, once again, Matthew 5, and in verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Sure enough, the Old Testament says you shall love your neighbor. The law of Moses says you shall love your neighbor. We read it a while ago. Where does it say you shall hate your enemy? Does it say that anywhere? It doesn't say it anywhere. You know, there were those among certain of the religious sects, the Essenes particularly, who regarded anyone outside their own miserable little cult to be the enemy. Not only did they hate the Gentiles, the Romans, not only did they hate the Samaritans, they even hated other Jews. They regarded them as the enemy. And Jesus says here, and he probably has those concepts in view, he says, you shall love your neighbor, or he goes on to say, I'm sorry, verse 44, but I say to you, love your enemies, and pray for those who persecute you, in order that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax gatherers do the same? He's saying you're no different from anybody else if you love only the people who love you. And if you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Therefore, you are to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. This idea of loving your neighbor and even loving your enemy, is that expressed anywhere in the law of Moses? People commonly believe that this is a brand new Testament, new covenant idea. But if you would turn back with me to Exodus 23, Exodus, the 23rd chapter, and let's see a passage here that has to do with the treatment of one's enemies. Exodus 23, verse 4. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. That's Old Testament. That's law of Moses. What does it say? Well, you show kindness to your enemy. Is that not what Jesus said? You shall love your enemy. The same thing. He says, if you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. You join there with him and you help him out. This is your enemy he's talking about. Is that not another way of saying, you put some of these feelings behind you. You express kindness to your enemy. You show a little bit of willingness to forgive and put things that are in the past and leave them there and go ahead and show kindness to your enemy. In Leviticus chapter 19, Leviticus 19, where we previously saw the commandment that has to do with loving your neighbor as yourself and forbidding hatred for your fellow countrymen, notice what it says about the stranger. The stranger was the alien, the Gentile, that occasionally came into the land and sometimes dwelt among the people. Leviticus 19 and verse 33, when a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. That's certainly not what the Essenes taught, who looked upon everyone who was not one of their own as an enemy, as an outsider, and they certainly didn't express love toward them. But he says, God is saying that the alien, the Gentile, the stranger who dwells among you, you love him as yourself. And in other places he speaks of the Egyptian. Even when the Egyptian comes among you, you love him. You be kind to him. He says, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. In other words, you don't come up with... Don't say, I was oppressed in your land, in the land of Egypt. Now it's your turn. Payback time. Oh, no, no, no. You remember what it was like when you were in Egypt, and you think about what you would like to have been, how you would like to have been treated when you were there. Haven't I read that someplace before? Some kind of rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you? And that's New Testament stuff, isn't it? Here it is in the law of Moses. I wonder how many people recognize that. How many people understand that these basic principles that Jesus Christ expounds in the Sermon on the Mount are already there in the law of Moses? He didn't come to radically revise. He didn't come to change things, to abolish this law and to retain that one and to give it another, a different spiritual interpretation or something. He didn't come and spiritualize the law. It was already a spiritual law. When the Apostle Paul said the law is spiritual, he didn't mean it became spiritual only after the time of Christ. It was already spiritual. The problem is that the people couldn't see it. They didn't understand it because they didn't have the heart of obedience. But had they had the heart of obedience, and there was a remnant in Israel that did, they did comprehend many of these things. In fact, some of the rabbinic sages understood some of the same things. We know this from their writings. Understood some of the same things that Jesus outlines in this chapter in Matthew 5. So, Jesus didn't radically revise the law and add some kind of brand new spiritual dimension that couldn't have been comprehended before. On the other hand, there was a new spiritual dimension that was added. Something has been added. Something has been made new. But understand, it's not the law. The law hasn't been made new. No, you have been made new. And I have been made new. To us has been added this new spiritual dimension. And if we have been renewed in the Spirit, then we're able to look at the law with different eyes. We're able to understand it, to comprehend it, to see in it these very things that Jesus Christ taught. The underlying principles of the law, the intent of the law, and we'll know how to apply it to our lives. If you want to see the mind of Christ on the subject of the law, let's look at it briefly in Psalm 119. This is the mind of Christ. Psalm 119, in closing, in verse 97, the psalmist says, "Oh, how I love thy law! It is my meditation all the day. Thy commandments make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever mine. I have more insight than all my teachers, for thy testimonies are my meditation." Dropping down to verse 105, "Thy word is a lamp to my feet, a light to my path." And verse 111, "I have inherited thy testimonies forever, for they are the joy of my heart. I have inclined my heart to perform thy statutes forever, even to the end." This, brethren, is the mind of Jesus Christ. Let's let it be our mind as well.